Love you.
Yay. Good evening. My name's Carl. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, Ralph. A real pleasure and a spectacular thing you have like stuck your neck way out to do here. It's a pretty bold move to go and arrange this at the hotel and get everybody to come into this room and to do this. I do think, based upon the people that are in this room, if somebody had a real resentment at Alcoholics Anonymous and wanted to put a real dent in the schedule for the upcoming conventions, they could come and take out this room and it would be a little bit of a glitch. Right? A few conventions would be scrambling for, what are we going to do now? Right? Oh, and my heroes are in this room too. And I got to tell you, I tried to do the math as I was listening to Clancy. And it's not an overstatement to say that was at least the 200th time in my 27 years of sobriety, because I hear you at least 10 times a year, at least. And I've been sober 27 years, so I've heard you definitely at least 200 times. And I got to tell you, I was sitting there with Howard and still laughing at the same spot that I did the very first time I heard you. And I know what's coming up, and I get excited like a little kid listening to his mother telling a bedtime story. And it's just the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous, of what you were saying, of one alcoholic sharing with another, that absolutely I can hear it again and again and again. I remember when I was fairly new, and I wasn't that excited about hearing the old-timers say the same thing again, because I didn't understand, and I was in some participation meeting, and there was one old-timer that was saying the same thing that I had heard him say at least 10 times before in the previous 3 months. And the first time I heard it, it almost knocked me out of my chair. I was just like, whoa! Right? But now this is the 10th time I've heard it. Now I'm sitting there with my sponsor and my sponsor's sponsor in the meeting. And I leaned over to my sponsor. I said, I can't believe the old-timer's saying the same thing again. And my sponsor's sponsor leaned past my sponsor and hit me right in the back of the head and said, he's not talking to you tonight. He's talking to the new person that apparently you don't know is in the room. And I was like, oh, there's other people in AA. How many people are in their first year? Excellent. Well worth leaving town to come here. Yeah. Well worth it. Because if I was here tonight to impress these guys here, it wouldn't have been worth leaving town. Even though I'm still in town. It's a weird feeling this weekend, being here at the thing, but I actually live in LA. It's a weird feeling. I do want to, and he said not to, to embarrass him, my friend Alan Kay from Des Moines, Iowa, emailed me and called me it must be 8 months, 9 months ago or so, and asked me for my three favorite verses out of the big book, and I said, okay, and sent it back to him. And before I knew it, sent to my office, is this thing, this is not the leather work of some guy in a mental institution, you know, where they learn how to make sandals and stuff, and then they give it to you when, right? This is amazing artwork. My name and sobriety date engraved. My three favorite verses from the book engraved. And the man in the bed done perfectly. I just, as Ralph had said, I wanted to just, you guys jealous yet? Oh, man. Anybody that's new or fairly new, in case you've heard that Alcoholics Anonymous is a cult, I want to try to disperse that. I mean, even well-meaning people say, yeah, go for a while. It's good that you're not drinking, but don't get into that cult version of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to dispel that idea for you if you're new or fairly new and let you know that Alcoholics Anonymous is not a cult, because a cult, this is what a cult tells somebody. Get rid of all your worldly possessions, quit speaking with your family, and come in here with us. That's what a cult says. A cult says, give up all your worldly possessions, quit speaking with your family, and come in here with us. Alcoholics Anonymous says, we know you don't have a damn thing left. Your family will not speak to you. Come in here, we'll teach you how to talk to your family, and maybe in between meetings you might get a couple of things back. Right? Exactly. But I'm an alcoholic. It's the most important thing about myself, and I'm going to try to, as it says in the portion of chapter 5, that our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal stories before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. And the very first idea is we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. Of course, the other two are for step 2, but I'm supposed to stick on step 1. So the combination of the description of the alcoholic in the big book and our personal stories, meaning they want you to read in the back of the book, or these days we have the luxury of going to a million meetings and listening to other people's stories. And that is literally how I worked step 1 in Alcoholics Anonymous, by listening to people like Clancy and listening to Bob and listening to Bill Cleveland and listening to Ralph and, you know, listening to Howard. I just sat there when I was new, he didn't even know who I was, and just hammered away. And I identified, and listening to Tom, and Larry. They're all here that I sat there and listened to again and again and again. And the reason I believe I'm an alcoholic is very, very simple. The reason I'm an alcoholic is that I've got a really strange relationship with alcohol. It's not very complicated. I'm an alcoholic because I've got a really strange relationship with alcohol. And this strange relationship that I have with alcohol takes on a few forms. The first part of this strange relationship that I have with alcohol happens when I drink it. A very strange thing happens when I drink booze. The book calls it an allergic reaction. And the book says the symptom of this allergic reaction that I get is what they call the phenomenon of craving. And the best way that I can describe this thing that the book calls the phenomenon of craving in my life is that it seems like whenever I drink booze, the more booze I drink, the thirstier I get. It happens with nothing else, just booze. An example of that is Lee was kind enough to give me this bottle of water. And over the next 45 minutes or an hour that I'm talking with you, I will probably drink at least half this bottle of water. I don't know. My mouth might get dry. I might finish the whole bottle of water. But I can absolutely guarantee you that once I finish this bottle of water, I am not going to go get a case of water and lock myself in the hotel room. There's no chance that I'm going to call up Polly later. Polly, get me another case of water, please. There's just no chance, right? There's no chance. But if that was the only thing that made me alcoholic, this bizarre physical reaction that I get, if that was the only thing that made me alcoholic, then Just Say No would have wiped out alcoholism. In the early 80s, Nancy Reagan came out and said, Just Say No. I would have, and I imagine you would have gone, ha ha, no. And we would have gone on living a happy, successful life just saying no. Maybe once a year we would have a Nancy Reagan weekend. And we would all, like, out of respect for this phenomenal change in our lives, get together and pat each other on the back and say, just say no. Right? And we would just, no problems. But I've got this other strange part of my relationship with alcohol. And that happens when I'm not drinking it. Oven by myself, if I don't drink for a day, a week, or a month, I seem to have this mind that is able to paint a picture that makes it okay to take another drink at all costs, no matter what the pain, humiliation, and suffering was a day, a week, or a month ago. And it never enters into the equation whether it was my pain and humiliation or your pain and humiliation. Could care less. Sooner or later, my mind will rationalize and justify my walk back to the next drink at all costs. So I cannot drink successfully because of this bizarre physical reaction that I get, this craving. So I cannot drink successfully, but I cannot, of and by myself, not drink successfully. I'm damned if I do, and I'm damned if I don't. It's the ultimate catch-22 we call alcoholism, because if I could do either one of those two things, either drink successfully or on my own not drink successfully, that's what I would be doing. I'm going to harp on that physical feature a little bit more, because it's really the one thing that, bar none, it's what we all have in common. Because, you know, if you're new or fairly new in Alcoholics Anonymous and somebody has told you, sit here until you hear your story, it's my humble opinion, you might be sitting here a long time. Because we are such a wide cross-section of society, right? I mean, we have so many different races, creeds, color, religion, background, good family, bad family, education, no education, what part of town, it was just all cross-section of society. In fact, Alcoholics Anonymous is the only place where the bank president, the bank teller, and the bank robber are all in the same room. And they all have a very different perception of what just happened. Right? So our stories are different on that level from our backgrounds, but our stories are also different because we drink differently also. As an example, let's say we, through these back doors, we wheeled in a giant cart with all the booze that we all love, right? There would be none of that, what kind, sunflower wine or whatever was that stuff that there'd be none of that hard, good stiff booze. What was that stuff that they, Sharon? So, no, your hippie friends that used to have the, right? Yeah. You guys have all heard Sharon's story. No, it was the bad wine that you didn't want to drink anymore. Oh, anyway. Anyway. Dandelion wine, that's it. That's worse than Boone's Farm. Let's say we wheeled in all the kind of booze we all love. Right? If you're a top shelf drinker, we got it. Right, there's some Remy Martin, some Gavassier. If you, that's what you drink, you know, we got it. If you're a bottom shelf drinker, we got it. Mad Dog 2020, we got it. And everything in between. And we wheeled it right in here, right in the center, and we all had a good four or five stiff drinks. No umbrellas in it, no mixer, just good four or five stiff drinks. We would all be acting very differently. Over in this corner, we'd have the good time crowd. Ah, ha, ha, talk, talk, talk. Ha, fun, fun, ha, talk. Da, da, fun, fun, fun. Add a little methamphetamine. We talk a little faster, right? Ah, ha, talk, talk, ha, fun, 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 fun. Right? The good time crowd. Over in this corner, we'd have the sobbers. Over in this corner, we'd have the fighters. Fight. Over in this corner, a bunch of us would be naked. I would be visiting each corner trying to find a couple of friends to come over here with me. So our stories are different on that level too, right? The good time crowd, lots of DUIs, always, you know, because, next bar, stop at the bar before we go to after hours party, right? Leave it 10 minutes to 1 before they quit, you know, like next party, right? Lots of DUIs. The sobbing corner, no DUIs, they don't even leave their house. Lots of drunk dialing, drunk texting, God forbid these days, drunk Facebooking, right? Right, over in the fighting corner, always got assault charges, always prison, they got a probation officer, they got parole officer, right? That's all in their story. Over here, lots of children by surprise over in this corner. Whoa! So our stories are different on that level. But there's one thing, no matter what corner we were in, there's one thing we would all be doing. We would all be back at the cart for more. It's one thing, no matter what corner, we'd all be back at that cart for more. I also seem to have, and I believe this is the crux of my problem, I seem to have a spiritual relationship with alcohol too. And it seems to be that this is the only thing that Alcoholics Anonymous seems to address. And it seems to be the thing that drove the bus for me my whole life. And I couldn't have described this spiritual relationship that I have with alcohol until I was like 13 years sober. It was the year 2000. And my mother called me and said, your brother is spending the summer with his wife and kids in the south of France. And Carl, let's go visit him, and we'll stop in Iceland on the way. And I go, I'm in, absolutely. And so we stopped in Iceland, and I met spectacular people. I've been back like 6 or 7 times since the year 2000. But that's not the point of the story. The point of the story is we go down to meet my brother and his family. They're spending the summer in the south of France. And they're staying at this beautiful place, and they got some nannies and stuff. And my brother, we're there about 3 days, I think, and my brother goes, let's all go out for a 13-course French meal. And Carl, you drive, right? Because I don't drink. And so I'm in. So they had the nannies watch the kids. And we drive and we go to this amazing castle, this chateau in the French countryside. And we're out in the courtyard. I mean, this is a once-in-a-lifetime experience. The reason I'm telling you this is a once-in-a-lifetime experience because I had never done this before and I've never done it since. So it's a once-in-a-lifetime experience. And we're sitting in this courtyard. And if you've ever had one of these 13-course French meals, the waiter will bring a tiny, tiny little bit of food 13 times. That's what they do. Right? It's like ridiculous, two bites. But with each of these tiny little bits of food, the waiter will bring this even smaller, ridiculous, embarrassingly small, tiny little glass of wine. And he will tell a story about the vineyard that this glass of wine is from. It's usually from the local region and the family who owned the vineyard and the history behind the family. It's all very interesting. My brother and his wife, they know a good drinking opportunity, and this is one. They're not alcoholic, and they were trying this one. If they liked one, they'd get two, and they'd say, tell us that story again. Ha, 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 and they were having a little... Me, I'm 13 years sober, so I'm trying all the Diet Cokes of the region. Do you have a story about this? I'm like, no, no, monsieur. But my mother, after two, just two, of these tiny, tiny little glasses of wine, says to the waiter, no more for me. And I just, Mom, I'm driving. Have a little more, for God's sake. And she goes, no, 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 I don't like the way it makes me feel. Now, I should have left well enough alone and just carried on with the evening. I really should have. But the way she said it, and I've always known that she is absolutely, I mean, she will accept a drink in social situations and she'll let it sit there. And if she can get away with not really finishing it, she will. That's the way she drinks. It's really bizarre. And that's literally, she'll say yes in social situations maybe three times a year. And so I said, Mom, how does it make you feel? And she said, Well, Carl, like you said, we're having a once-in-a-lifetime experience. I'm sitting here in this amazing courtyard, looking at the brilliant colors of the French countryside at sunset. I'm listening to the string quartet over there, and the music is rattling my bones. And I'm here talking with three of the people I love the most in the world. And if I were to drink a little bit too much alcohol, the colors will start to get dull and blurry. The music will start to sound shallow and off in the distance, and I'll have a hard time keeping a conversation going with you. Do you get that? That is the exact opposite relationship to alcohol than I have. Because what she's saying is, up and by herself, she sees the colors of life. She hears the music, and she can connect with God's other kids. And if she adds a little bit too much alcohol, it gets dull, boring, and sloppy. Me, of and by myself, I cannot see the music, see the colors of life. I can't hear the music, and you're goddamn boring. I get four or five drinks in me, and the colors come alive. The music, oh. I will tell you where that cello was made, whether I know or not. I can make up the name of a German village on the spot. Bang! And you become very interesting, but not as interesting as me. I look over at my brother and his wife. They're having a good time. And I go, do you feel like Mom, but you just get past that something? They go, no, no, no. We like to escape. We like that blurry, goofy feeling. So once in a while, we like it. Ah. Right? It's no wonder they don't go to the gates of insanity or death for it. No wonder. I remember having this feeling of, oh, wow, wow. And then it hit me. That's why Alcoholics Anonymous says I must have a spiritual awakening. Because what they're telling me is that I'd better figure out a way to see the colors of life, to hear the music of life, and connect with you, or I will not get to stay. I set this relationship up that I just described to you with alcohol right from the get-go, right from the very get-go. It was almost instantaneously when I look back at my drinking, and I started drinking much, much later than most people in AA. I was 11. It is. It's very late these days. We lived in Seattle. Just want to throw in for any of you. I understand why you guys were hesitant to get away from the basketball game in there if it would have been a Seahawk game. Because I'm just like really having a good year this year. I really am. Just like, oh. I have a 7-year-old son that just thinks the Seahawks have always been the best team. We lived in Seattle. A typical morning for me in seventh grade would be I'd show up early for school, not for study hall or anything, but to meet my new friends at the very edge of the school property, Loser's Corner. Every school's got a Loser's Corner. It's 10 feet off of the school property. We would hang out there and smoke cigarettes and try to look cool, right? And we would also have what I like to call the playground cocktail. That is a jar full of whatever you could rip off out of the parents' liquor cabinet the night before. That jar is very scary because none of us have been to bartending school yet. Right? And you're also in a big hurry when you're ripping off from the parents. Right? And so we're drinking this out of a jar in seventh grade. And it's also the early 70s, so we're smoking that commercial pot. Anybody remember that stuff? Four-finger lids, $10 a bag, seeds and stems and the whole bit. It was even before Ziploc baggies were invented. Regular Glad sandwich bag. As you'd roll it up, there'd be like 9 people spit on it. Were you guys there too? Oh. By the time I'm 14 there in Seattle, I'm the neighborhood drunk. I'm the neighborhood pot dealer. I forgot to mention, but my father was a neighborhood Lutheran minister. Swedish Lutheran. My parents were really, really good people. But they didn't understand what was happening to their son. Didn't understand that he had developed this acute allergy to alcohol. They didn't understand that this invisible obsession that they knew nothing about had taken hold of their son. All they saw was I no longer cared about Little League. I could care less about school. And then these other telltale signs like my hair is growing down onto my shoulders, my eyes are red, and my vocabulary is, whoa, wow, whoa, right? That's my vocabulary. And they blame my problems on people, place, and things because they didn't understand alcoholism, right? They blame my problems. We can get them away from that group of kids he's hanging out with, things to get better. Get them out of that school, that public school system. That's the thing. Well, get them out of there. Get them in private school. They tried all of the above. They did all of the above. But you see, I'm an alcoholic. My problems are not based upon people, place, and things. My problems are based upon my physical and mental relationship to alcohol. You see, if you change the people, place, and things in somebody's life like mine, all that happens is that I'm loaded with different people in different places, ruining different things. That's all that happens. And I'm going to throw an idea out there, and I got to tell you, I don't know if it's happened to some of you others that do this a number of times, but it's possible that in the year 2020 or something, I might disagree with what I'm about to say. And it's a bummer because it's on tape, right? Has it ever happened to you where somebody comes up to you after you, they go, you know, I really disagree with what you said, and I go, what did I say? You said this, this, and this, and this. What year was that, CD? Oh, 1998. Well, I disagree with that too now. They'll go, huh? But I'm going to throw out an idea about this people, place, and things. You see, quite often in meetings every once in a while, not in Covina because we're the sobriety capital of the world, right? Yay. But they say I'm powerless over alcohol, people, place, and things. I don't buy that. It's not my experience. It's not what I actually feel the people that wrote the big book of alcoholics, it's not what Bill and the original, when they used the word powerless, I believe they were trying to use a very powerful word to describe a very unique situation of this bizarre relationship to alcohol that I have. And I don't have that relationship with people, place, and things. I need new tools for living with people, place, and things when I get here. But, you know, I absolutely love this book that Alan got me, and the leather and everything. It's a thing. Now that I have this thing in my hand, I'm not thinking about how I'm going to get your big book. I'm not craving more big books. I have no craving when I've got this thing. I'm not obsessing about it now. I'm not wondering, man, I got to get that. I don't have that relationship there with that. I don't have an allergy of the body, an obsession of the mind, and a spiritual relationship with that. So I'm not, I don't believe the same word should be used. And here's another piece of perspective on this, as I might say. If I stay sober and apply these principles that Alcoholics Anonymous wants me to apply in my life, I'll start having some success with people, place, and things. And let's say I'm 6, 7, 10 years sober and I've started to experience some success with people, place, and things. And if I'm powerless over alcohol, people, place, and things, and I'm now having success by applying these principles with people, place, and things, maybe I can have success with alcohol. Just an idea to throw out there. By the time I was 17, I barely scraped out of the public school system there in Seattle. My parents decided that Seattle was a problem. Get them out of Seattle, things would get better. So they sent me 300 miles away to Washington State University. I spent 3 years at that university on my parents' money. And in that 3 years, I got almost 10 credits. Almost. At any given time, my grade point average matched my blood alcohol content. About a 0.25. By the time I was 22, this little story I'm about to tell you will let you know exactly where I stood with my family. Now, my father was Swedish, my mother is Icelandic, therefore I look like a polar bear. And I don't know whether this custom I'm about to tell you about is Scandinavian or whether it's Lutheran. I don't know. But at Christmas time, my parents wouldn't just send out Christmas cards to their friends and relatives. My parents would send out this big, long Christmas letter that said everything the family had been doing that year. When I was about 22, I got a hold of one of these letters that had been sent out the previous Christmas. And as I read it, it let me know exactly where I stood with my family. Now, the first paragraph talked about what my parents had been doing that year. Another impressive year, I'm sure. The next paragraph talked about what the Morris children had been doing that year. And that paragraph went something like this. Our oldest daughter, Christina, just graduated from Cornell University in Ithaca, Newark, with a master's degree in human resources. She's now working for a large pharmaceutical company in the Midwest. She traveled to Europe this summer. She saw this, she saw that. Her hobbies are this, this, and this. She's a very happy young woman. We are very proud of her. Our oldest son, Eric, just graduated from Western Washington State University with a degree in marketing. He's now working for a large advertising firm here in downtown Seattle. He loves the golf. He loves to travel. He's engaged to be married to this wonderful woman named Mary Lou, who works for a very small company here in Seattle named Microsoft. Now we explain the south of France and the nannies, right? No resentment for me. They love to golf together. They love to travel together. He's a very happy young man. We are very proud of him. Our youngest son, Carl, just turned 22. They were actually being very kind. It's about this same time, a really bad night happened. It really would take till breakfast to describe, and a really bad night happened, and it was such a bad night that I joined the Navy. It was that bad of a night, and what I'm about to tell you should scare the living daylights out of you if you care anything about the security of the United States, but on my way into the Navy, I passed a potential test, and this test that I took qualified me to become a nuclear engineer. That should concern you that the United States Navy has any type of system in place that would even maybe possibly or even remotely allow somebody like me near anything nuclear. However, they made me take another test when I showed up at that base for boot camp, and I could not pass that particular test. That test is called a urinalysis test, is what it's called. Never knew how to study for those things. I still remember. I had been in boot camp for about 10 days, and the Master at Arms came in. He had this clipboard, and they started to name off about six names. I knew my name would be on that list. I knew it. It was obvious. And we were taken over to the other side of the Great Lakes Naval Base, to the administrative side, and there was about five other guys, and they were put into one office, and I was taken into a completely separate building and marched right into the commanding officer's office, the guy who ran the whole Great Lakes Naval Base. Big office, big oak desk, pictures of naval vessels up on the wall. The man sitting behind the desk had so much gold on his shoulders it would blind you on a bad morning. And he asked me my name. I gave him my name, and this would have been the early 80s, so he had on top of this oak desk, he had a telephone and a speakerphone attachment attached to it, and he pushed the button on the speakerphone, and he said, "Walt, that's my father's name." My father had been, at that point, a reservist chaplain in the United States Navy. He was active in two wars and a reservist for 40 years. This was an old World War II buddy of my father's. So into this phone, he goes, "Walt, out of consideration for our long-term friendship, I thought I should ask you before I did anything. I'm supposed to kick your son out of the Navy right now. But out of consideration for our long-term friendship, I wondered maybe I should talk to you. What do you think we ought to do with your son?" Now, normally, if you met my father, you could tell when you'd meet him by his body language and his voice that he really had a passion for life. He loved life. You could sense it when you met him. He thought life was an immense privilege. He had lived he was living a rich and full life, and he was enjoying it, and you knew it when you met him. There was another voice and another body language that would come out of that man. And it was a voice like somebody had just kicked him right below the belt, and his shoulders would slump down, and his voice would be very weak and destroyed. And I'd heard that voice many, many times, and it was always when he was dealing with me. And that's the voice I heard come out of that speakerphone that morning, and I heard my father's very weak and destroyed voice say, "It's just none of my concern anymore." And then I heard, and I can still hear this today, click, this dial tone. And the man looked up from the desk, and he looked at me right in the eyes. And I didn't know how to look other people in the eyes. And he looked at me, and he decided to keep me in the Navy anyway. Took away that nuclear status thing. Thank God for you guys. Kept me in the Navy anyway, and a year and a half later, I'm a lower rank than when I first came in. Can happen, anybody. Here's the problem. I'm 23, I'm 24, I'm 25 years old in this time period I'm talking about. Here's the problem. I knew I was in the Navy. I knew it. It was obvious. All I had to do was look around at my surroundings. I'm on a big gray ship in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, and I'm in a uniform. It was obvious. I'm in the Navy. That ship would pull into a port. I would leave that ship, and I'd take a drink. And I would totally forget that I'm in the United States Navy. And I would come back to that ship when the drunk was over. And here's the real problem. I'm 23, I'm 24, I'm 25 years old. And at this point in my life, when I take a drink, I have no idea whether it's going to be 3 hours or it's going to be 3 days. I was finding myself on these three-day binges that were just baffling to me. And it's a very strange feeling coming out of one of those three-day binges, and I'm in a foreign country. And it's 6 a.m., and I'm standing on a large pier going, "There was a destroyer here the other day." And then the thought would hit me, how am I going to explain this to my superiors? Readily supplanted by the thought, I can't even explain this to myself. Can't even explain this to myself. I was at the end of another three-day drunk, but this time I was in port in San Diego, and I'd been on another three-day drunk. It was early Monday morning at 6 or 7 a.m. in between that time frame, and I'm late getting back to the ship. And I'm doing what I always do at the end of one of these things, is I'm racing to get in the ship. I'm driving, and I've got a half a pint. I'm trying to drink half of it, and I'm going to slide the rest underneath my seat so I can at noontime run out and finish the bottle. It's my way of sliding into Tuesday. And I'm paying more attention to getting that half a pint in me than I am where the car's going. And all of a sudden my eyes came into focus, and at the front of every naval base there's a guard shack where a Marine stands guard. Under normal circumstances, you're supposed to politely and slowly pull up at the guard shack. You're supposed to show him your military ID. He'll check the sticker on your car. If everything's in order, he'll allow you to proceed onto the base. I remember my eyes came into focus. I was kind of like, and the Marine had his head out of the guard shack, and he was like, and I was wondering what he was so excited about till I looked down and realized I was still going 40 miles an hour. I yanked the wheel. I tried to swerve. The car hit this median on the right-hand side and flipped over and bam, right through the guard shack. I can still see that Marine doing this big dive out of there. He did a quick somersault and he was right back up. Thank God those guys are in good shape, right? Now, I'm in a twisted metal, broken glass. There's a big chunk of the guard shack is taken out, and I'm thrown into the back seat of the car, and I'm not thinking, oh, my God, what have I done? Is the Marine all right? Oh, that's not what I'm thinking. I'm thinking, where's that bottle? Now, it's not because that bottle would be evidence to incriminate me when the authorities show up. I need to know where that bottle is because I know, based upon my experience in situations like this, the authorities will be arriving soon. They always do. And based upon my experience in situations like this, once the authorities arrive and see what happened, and they pinpoint me as the culprit, it's going to be a while till I get a drink. They just don't cooperate. So I may as well just get it in me. That morning, they're patching me up at the hospital, at the Naval Hospital, and the Marine was all right. They're patching me up at the hospital. They're reading new charges on me, and new charges, nothing significant or new in my life. New charges, that's just what happens in a guy's life like mine about every 90 days if you're living the way I'm living. So there's nothing significant about that. But the most significant thing that happened that morning is the Navy doctors prescribed this stuff called Anabuse for me. I was now under orders to show up at sick bay every morning before the corpsman, before quarters, and the corpsman would put this little white pill on my tongue and make me sit there for half an hour to make sure it actually ingested in my system. Over the next 7 to 10 days, I started to experience the most cunning, baffling, and powerful side of this thing we call alcoholism, and that is I had no alcohol or drugs in my system, and I was slowly going insane. The best way that I've ever heard described in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, the way that I feel, when you take alcohol away from me and you do not give me specifically Alcoholics Anonymous. I sometimes hear people say, when you take alcohol away from me, you need to give me something. No, you need to give me specifically, uniquely, Alcoholics Anonymous, or this is what happens to me when you take alcohol away from me. Because there's only two choices in my life, either drinking or Alcoholics Anonymous. Right? There is no, as the book says, and it's one of the favorite ones, there is no middle-of-the-road solution. I either have to have alcohol or I got to have Alcoholics Anonymous. Those are my two choices. And the best way I've ever heard it described the way I feel when you take alcohol away from me and you don't give me Alcoholics Anonymous is that I feel like a scream looking for a mouth. This one guy in my home group recently said this. He's Native American and he just said it a beautiful way. He said, when I don't got alcohol in me and I don't have Alcoholics Anonymous, I feel like I'm made of sand and the wind is blowing. And that is exactly the way that I feel. And I remember counting those days on that Anabuse, just it's been 4 days and I'm on Anabuse. Now it's been 6 days and I'm on Anabuse. Now it's been 8 days, 6 hours, and 15 minutes. And I'm on Anabuse. And I started to look around that ship. The other men, they're talking behind my back. All 300 of them. Have you ever felt that way in AA? The only difference is that in AA, we are talking behind your back. It's not an illusion. We're really doing it. The 10th day, I just snapped, and I went AWOL from my ship, and I locked myself in a little hotel room, Plaza Hotel, 4th and Broadway. It's still there. This would have been 1986. It was $13 a night. They've upgraded that area of San Diego. The Plaza Hotel is now $19 a night. And I remember sitting on the edge of this little bed, looking at this little end table, and I had the bottle of vodka sitting on there and a little shot glass. As I stared at the bottle of vodka, I remembered that the Navy doctors had warned me when they had prescribed this antabuse for me. They had said, "Son, you need to understand that if you drink on top of this antabuse, you will get one of two reactions. One reaction is you will get violently ill. The other reaction is you might die." I remember looking at the bottle and I thought, well, I wonder which reaction I'm going to get. I took one shot and nothing happened. Authority had lied to me again as far as I was concerned. Waited about 2 minutes just to make sure, and I took another shot. All of a sudden I felt tingly in the face, so I looked in this cracked little mirror that was in this hotel room, and I was bright red, blotchy and purple in places. Took another shot. All of a sudden I could feel my heart going boom, boom, boom. Looked at my shirt, I was drenched in sweat, and all of a sudden I was like, hyperventilating. Oh, we're doing all right so far. You guys are quite sick if you think this is funny. Really, if you think that's funny, there's something wrong with you. I actually have proof. I'm going to skip ahead a couple of years just to prove that although you look all very, very nice tonight, there's apparently something wrong. Skip ahead a couple of years. I'm going to come back to the hotel room. Important step one stuff going on there. I mean, getting surrendered by drinking on top of antabuse. 2 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. My first sponsor and his sponsor were real sticklers about that ninth step while I was still in the Navy, and they had me doing a lot of stuff. But one of the things that I was unable to do while I was still in the Navy in my first 2 years of sobriety was that my parents had paid for a bachelor's degree. I did not have one. I had two choices, according to them. I either had to pay my parents back every single nickel for the bachelor's degree that they had wasted on me, or I had to go get what they had paid for in the first place. And so when I got out of the Navy, that's how I moved to Covina. The university I was going to go to was in Covina, and I moved on up to Covina. And in the first couple of semesters of this telecommunications business bachelor's program that I took, I had to take a business presentation course. It's like a speech class for giving business presentations. And in the first couple of days of this class, the instructor was pointing at students one at a time, throwing them up in front of the room. From the back of the room, he would shout out a topic. And we were supposed to, you know, talk for 2-3 minutes on whatever the instructor said. And the instructor was doing this just to see what he had to work with for the semester. And after about 7 or 8 students were thrown up there, he points at me. And I walk up to the front of the room, and the instructor says, "Talk about a bizarre situation in your life." So I told them about drinking on top of antabuse. They didn't respond the way you guys did. They were like, there were a couple of guys in back going, "Woo, right on, dude, woohoo." So I'm back in the hotel room, I'm red faced, I'm hyperventilating, I'm sweating, and I took another shot. And up it came. My second sponsor, Eddie Cochran, passed away in 1999 with 47 years of sobriety. Man, really changed the course of my life in Alcoholics Anonymous. I used to follow him around everywhere he went. It's one of the most important things I ever did. It's one of the most important things I found out about a relationship with a sponsor, too, is at some point I need to change the relationship where I'm asking him to do stuff for me and I'm asking him, what can I do for him? It's funny, whenever I've had three sponsors. My first sponsor was a guy in the Navy. My second sponsor was Eddie Cochran. My current sponsor is Ray G. It's amazing that when I treat them with what can I do for them, they become the most brilliant men in Alcoholics Anonymous. When I sit there and wonder, they aren't doing much for me anymore, they start to sound rather, you know, shallow. It all seems to have to do with my perception and what I'm doing in Alcoholics Anonymous. Eddie called this next thing that happened to me on this antabuse projectile regurgitation. This is the level of puking I was unfamiliar with. Because we all know normal puking, right? Get that little sour taste in the back of the throat, a little bit comes up in the mouth, and we kind of go, And we all know we have 30 to 60 seconds to find a bathroom or get the window down if we're driving, or if it's our friend's shoe, that's just the way it goes tonight. But we get the warning. But here on the Antabuse, no warning. It's ha! Sort of a Linda Blair spray across the room. Thank God the Plaza Hotel is the type of hotel room where the toilet is in the same room with the bed. It's a design feature, I believe, maybe to make convicts feel more at home upon release. I'm not really sure. But I found the magic of drinking on top of Antabuse, and that is if I were to keep drinking and keep puking and keep drinking and keep puking for about an hour to an hour and a half, enough of the Antabuse would kick out of my system and I would quit throwing up and I would just be left with red face, hyperventilating and sweating, and I'm all right with that. I drank on top of Antabuse for 7 months. I was not drinking every day. I think I probably drank in that 7 months about 13 to 15 times. And I got to tell you, when I got here to Alcoholics Anonymous, there was something about that allowed me to sit here. And there's a number of old-timers in our area that say there's two types of people that come to Alcoholics Anonymous, those that are surrendered and those that are not. And if you stay here long enough, you will get surrendered. And I was surrendered and I didn't even know it. Because when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, you guys were speaking a language that absolutely was hitting me right between my eyes. I still remember I was thrown into a treatment center, handcuffs. The treatment center, as far as I'm concerned, is one of the best in the world simply because they were taking us to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. They understood they also were powerless over alcoholism. Right? They understood the concept that I'm powerless over alcohol whenever I get into the ring with it, whether I'm drinking it or you're drinking it. They didn't think they had some sort of new fangled thing to do for us if they just used enough science or money on us. They weren't under that delusion. They just did what they could do to help us with our health and talk to us a little bit, and then they sent us out to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous every single night. And I remember the very first meeting I was in. I literally, you guys started to do your meeting, and I identified. I remember the very, very first thing I remember hearing in Alcoholics Anonymous is a guy got up. In San Diego, they don't let you sit in your chair when you're sharing. They call, you got to come up to the podium. Lots of them are podium participation meetings. And this guy got called and he walked all the way from the back of the room, and I'm sitting in the back with the other Navy guys. This guy walks all the way to the front. He says one sentence and he sat down. And I remember he just knocked me right out of my chair. He said, "My mind would have killed my body a long time ago, except it needed it for transportation." And he sat down. I want to say, "Did you hear that?" I followed him back to his chair like, "Whoa." My second meeting, I got really I totally identified the first meeting because what was happening was I was identifying, because I believe those people were sharing responsibly in that meeting, because there's two things that I was identifying with. I was identifying with the way they described their drinking, and what was even more important than that was I was identifying with the way they described the way they felt when they were not drinking. Because that had been what had been killing me my whole life. I didn't know how to word it to you. I didn't know how to explain it to you. You guys were all defining my alcoholism by the things I was doing, and you're pointing at, you know, wrecked cars and lost jobs, and the Navy's angry and saying, "Why did you do that? Look at what you did." And Mom and Dad are like, "Look at what you did." And I'm like, "I know, I agree. I don't like the fact that that car's on fire either. I'm not happy. What do you think, I'm happy about that? I agree with you. But if you knew how I felt when I wasn't drinking, you wouldn't be asking me why I drink." And you guys were talking about that. My very first meeting, I heard you guys talking about that. Second night, I got really confused. Because a bunch of people were talking about something called a drug of choice. I used to hear that all the time back in the 80s. Don't hear it much anymore. But people were, "Well, my drug of choice is..." And somebody goes, "Well, my drug of choice is..." And I'm sitting in the back saying, "Oh, for Christ's sake, was I supposed to be choosing out there?" Do they want me to choose now? What are they talking about? So the next morning, I'm back at the treatment center. I asked the counselor who'd been assigned to us. I go, Mary, last night in the meeting, they're talking about something called a drug of choice. What do they mean by that? And she said, Carl, let's play a game. Now, that kind of startled me, worried me, that because I knew what she was saying. She was saying, Carl, pay attention. And that was hard. I didn't know why. I now know why it was hard to pay attention, because when I had shown up at that treatment center, they'd done a medical checkup on me. They found my liver was shutting down. It was extended, like way out, like a 70-year-old man, they said. It was way out. My pancreas was shutting down. I had extreme alcoholic edema. Like if you push your skin like that, it sits there. Apparently, drinking on top of Anabuse for 7 months does a little number on your internal organs. Just a little information for you. And so they had salted my tail with what they call detox medication so that you don't throw the floppy fish, right, and disturb the other patients and everybody goes, ah, right? It sort of interrupts the schedule for the day. So they give you these medications. If you've ever been on those, you know what I'm talking about. Your field of vision like this is just fine, this wide. But over here, there's dancing squiggly things. And when you turn to see what it is, now it's over here. And so you're doing a lot of that. True. And so when Mary said, Carl, let's play a game, I went, okay. She said, well, figure out what your drug of choice is, Carl. Imagine I walked into this room, she said, and I had a tray. And on that tray, I had a bottle of Jack Daniels, an ounce of cocaine, and an ounce of Thai sticks. Which one would you take? I started to drool immediately, right? So I was like, I said, I take them all! And she started snap her fingers. Settle down, Carl. Settle down. Back in the room now. Settle down. You can't have them all. You can only have one. Which one would you take? And I said, well, I guess if I can only have one, Mary, I guess I'd take the ounce of cocaine. She said, ah, maybe cocaine is your drug of choice. Do you understand now? And I said, no. She said, what's the problem? I said, well, Mary, the only reason I take the ounce of cocaine over the other two is, well, I'd take that ounce of cocaine and I'd get the hell out of this place. And I'd sell 2 8-balls. Now I'd have enough money for a quarter pound of Thai sticks and a case of Jack Daniels. Now, the only reason I bring that up is to bring up a very important aspect of Alcoholics Anonymous that I learned that day but didn't know I learned it that day. You guys have a bunch of stuff in your sobriety that you didn't know you learned it that day, but you now know you learned it that day, right? And it's a really important concept of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's really important, and that is sobriety dates. We need to have one. Alcoholics Anonymous makes a lot more sense when you have one. And on top of that, it needs to be written in stone. It's the one thing that nobody can take from us, and nobody should be able to question. Especially us in the middle of the night. And there's only one sobriety date, no matter what we may think our drug of choice is when we're new. I don't know if you guys run across this where you... I know for an absolute fact, due to the nature of the people in this room, that you guys all work with lots of new people. And maybe you run across this scenario like I do every once in a while. Not very often. But every once in a while, see some new guy, hey, good to see you, how long do you got? And every once in a while, I get this kind of response. Well, my drinking sobriety date is January 4th. My pot clean date is May 3rd. Or I blew my methamphetamine date last night. I was in Walmart all night long. No. Funniest thing I ever heard about sobriety date. Same scenario. I saw this guy around my home group for a while. Hey, good to see you, how long do you got? And he said, well, I had 90 days. But I drank last night, so now I have 89 days. I almost had to call my sponsor. Think that kind of falls into the same category as being down in Mexico looking at the tequila going, would that affect my U.S. sobriety date? Yes. Yes. Sobriety dates are international. Just a little information for the new guy. I'm going to throw out an idea here that I am going to talk from my own experience. We often hear an awful lot of stuff that you got to find rigorous honesty or you're not going to be able to stay sober. My experience that most of us in this room, had we had to be rigorously honest in all areas of our life from the get-go, this room would be very empty. Here's a couple of things that were going on in my life that continued to go on for a while, and I still was able to stay sober. Now, I believe that along the way, I had to address a lot of this, or I wasn't going to be able to stay sober long term, because this life gets too complicated when you're covering this up to do this, and life, you know, you just can't keep doing it and interact with you guys in an honest way. So I wouldn't be able to stay long term, but early sobriety. In the middle of one of my times I was drinking on top of Anabuse near the end of my drinking, I ran across this old college girlfriend, and we thought it was a good idea in the middle of a three-day drunk to go get married. Only because the Navy pays you double. Not because we were under any illusion of love. The Navy pays you double when you're married. It seemed like a reasonable thing at the time. So we were there, and a little woman in Chula Vista put on a little record table player. And another guy from my ship was the best man, right? And we turned in this paperwork. Now, I'm thrown into treatment, and she ran off to get it annulled because they had contacted her. The Navy was contacting her for family counseling. She didn't want to go to family counseling. And so she annulled it and delivered the paperwork to me in the treatment center. Now, my bunk mate in treatment was what's called a personnelman. That is a Navy clerk. So I go, well, I'm not at my duty station. You're a personnelman, a clerk. What should I do with this paperwork? He said, throw it in the garbage can right now. Don't let the Navy know that you're not married. They will cut your pay in half. So I took his advice. I now went from fraud to embezzlement, just like that. Instantaneously. And I did not do anything about that till I was 6 months sober and had to turn that in to the Navy, but still was able to stay sober. Lying, lying, lying. But I was truthful, rigorously honest about my relationship with alcohol. That's what I believe when they talk about the rigorous honesty that I need to have to stay sober, is I need to tell myself the truth about my relationship with alcohol. Now, I'm not going to be able to stay comfortable very long having that go on in my life without cleaning it up. But it's not the thing in early sobriety that's going to get me drunk. It's what I believe they're referring to is that I lie to myself about my relationship with alcohol. I even lied to myself, let alone you guys. I want to use this example. I was about 4 months sober, and this woman with 4 years sober 13th stepped me. It was horrible. I couldn't believe she did it. Just horrible. She was going to school, getting a master's degree in psychology. I think she was dating me as a case study, I think. But when you start dating, you start to tell each other at some point when you lost your virginity. She told me the story, and her story, and I told her mine about my parents used to travel a lot when I was adolescent, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. My parents traveled a lot. They used to use this college-age girl, this 19-year-old girl, to house sit. And I told Chris that, well, when I was 12, this house sitter, college girl, showed me the ways of love. Well, Chris went, you were molested as a child. And I thought, I didn't feel molested. She goes, no, I'm reading about that. This is serious. This is really serious. You need to figure out what to do. And I'm thinking, I'm just trying not to take a drink, for God's sake. I'm just wandering around going, oh my God. Wow. Next day I'm at a meeting. It's a 6 o'clock gong show meeting in Pacific Beach. Big meeting, still going on. Podium participation. And I'm sitting there, and they call on people. They don't have people raise their hand. They call on people, and they never call on me. And I'm just sitting in the chair. I'm like, God, I'm trying not to take a drink, and I've been molested as a child. It's like, I can't believe this. And apparently the leader of the meeting saw me having a mental breakdown, and he said, hey, you, white hair Navy guy, You want to say something? No. And I walk up to the podium, and all of them are looking at me just like you guys are looking at me. And I'm like, I can't believe this. I just try not to take a drink. I got four and a half months, and this girl I'm dating says that I was molested as a child. And as I'm standing there telling this to you guys, all of a sudden it hit me like a ton of bricks. That never happened. My best friend Dave got laid at 15. I had to come up with a better story. I had been telling the story so often that it was now real. And I remember I just, mid-sentence, just went, I'm sorry, that's a lie. And I got back to my seat and I had one of those experiences where it's just like, what else in my life is a lie? What else is a lie? The magic of Alcoholics Anonymous is one alcoholic sharing with another. And we do it through telling our stories. We do it through telling our experience with our steps. That's what separates us from other spiritual movements. This is the unique nature of what is Alcoholics Anonymous. It's what I've fallen in love with. It's like I've got this little thing in my heart, this little vibrating thing that when you're talking alcoholism and Alcoholics Anonymous, this little thing inside me goes, and I'm with you. And it happens in meetings where people are conscientious of what they're saying, and I get this, I'm there. But then there's other, but it goes quiet sometimes because they're just talking about something else. And the way I learned about this beautiful magic of one alcoholic sharing with another, I'll never forget. I think I've got a couple of more minutes here. My first sponsor, Bob W., he's the guy that took me through the book in the middle of the Pacific Ocean down in the engine room on the USS Cushing. We called it the USS Cushing Underway Meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was me and him. And we had the book, and I would read, and he would read, and he was only 14 months ahead of me, shared what little he knew. And he was no expert. He understood that step 12 says, having had a spiritual awakening is the result of these steps. We tried to carry this message, not successfully or expertly. He tried. But whenever the ship would pull into a port, we would split a hotel room to get off the ship. And we were in Victoria, British Columbia this particular time. And we split a hotel room at the Strathcona. If you've ever been there, still there. Strathcona's there. And we went out to the AA clubhouse, and we went to the meeting. And after the meeting, my first sponsor, Bob W., said, you know, Carl, I'm not feeling well. I'm going back to the hotel room. And I stayed out with the AAers for a while. I went to another meeting, maybe went out for coffee. But, you know, about an hour and a half later, I come back to the hotel room. And there's Bob. He had found this guy from our ship named Blair. And Blair was wasted. He'd taken him out of a gutter. Blair has puke on him. He's got stuff from the street on him. He's been on a two-day drunk, and Blair's just hammered. And Bob has him on my bed, propped up against the headboard with an end table and a chair and a pillow. And Bob is in his bed reading the big book of the... We are more than 100 men and women who have... And I look at this scenario and I think, this is ridiculous. It's ridiculous. Blair doesn't even... Blair's like... And I think, Blair didn't even know where he's at. Bob, why are you wasting your time? But I threw my 10 cents in, and then we carried him back to the ship, right, to make sure he was okay, got him into his rack, and he was safe. And last we heard of Blair for a while. 3 weeks later, we're back in port in San Diego, and I'm in my rack at 3 a.m. in the morning, and all of a sudden on the side of my rack is, Carl, wake up, wake up! And it's Bob, my first sponsor. Wake up! Blair's on the Coronado Bridge. We got to go get him. Apparently, in the last few weeks, Blair has tried to drink. He's tried not to drink. He's apparently at the jumping off place. He's up on the Coronado Bridge. And I don't know if you know the Coronado Bridge well enough to know, but back in the 80s and 90s and early 2000s, they had suicide hotline phone up there. Now they give you a cell number. They assume that if you're going to commit suicide, at least you got a cell phone, right? But they used to have these little suicide hotline phones up there. And they are hoping that you might, you know, in case you have a little change of heart. They're hoping your feet are still on the bridge when you'd have that change of heart. I don't know how many people may have, in the middle of the jump, gone, maybe this isn't it either. But Blair had gotten onto the phone, and he was talking to a very well-meaning, highly qualified suicide hotline counselor. And this is what Blair was apparently saying to the counselor. I will only talk to Bob W. Suicide hotline counselor's going, who's Bob W.? Blair was saying, it's anonymous. She goes down to get her boss, another well-meaning suicide hotline counselor, and they get on the phone and they start doing the good cop, bad cop, hammering quick questions back and forth, confusing them. They find out he's from the Navy and what ship he's from. So they take a stab in the dark and they call down to the quarterdeck of our ship and ask, is there a Bob W. on that ship? Now, my first sponsor, he would guard your anonymity at the level of that ship, but he never guarded his own so he could be of service at any time. So the guy who answered the phone at 3 a.m., yeah, Mr. 12 Steps, we know all about him. So they go down and get Bob. Bob comes and goes, car, wake up. Like, all right. So we get into Bob's car. We start driving down to the base of the Coronado Bridge, and we're driving, and Bob says, Carl, get the big book out of the glove box. Bone up on working with others. Like, says, see your man alone if possible, Bob. He goes, ah, forget it. We're going to wing it tonight. We get down to the base of the Coronado Bridge, and everything that San Diego County has available for a situation like this, they're there. The paramedics are there. The fire department is there. The police department is there. The on-duty psychologist is there. And they've got this little contraption wired up to talking to Blair up on the bridge, and we walk up on this scene, and fireman who seems to be in charge goes, is one of you Bob W.? Bob goes, yeah, that's me. He goes, I don't know what you're going to do. We've been talking for an hour and a half, and he ain't budging. But here, go ahead. The fireman hands Bob this little speakerphone, and Bob goes, Blair? And you can hear on the other end, Bob, is that you? He goes, yes, Blair, it's me. Now get the hell down from that bridge. You hear, okay. One alcoholic can touch another alcoholic in a way that no one else can. Don't forget that. It means we have a responsibility to take our seat in the meeting. There's nobody that can help us but us. Before I sit down, I need to talk about my beautiful, beautiful friend, Polly Pistol. That woman has been there in my sobriety at the most important times of my life. She's been there when I've been stuck in Texas when my son is being born. She's been there through a divorce. She's been there when I was getting married. She's been there when career things have turned upside down and I'm out on doing what you guys ask us to do. She's always been there for me. She's like this beacon of that it's going to be all right, Carl. In fact, it is all right. Alcoholics Anonymous has their arms around you, Carl. Sometimes doesn't feel like it. Sometimes it feels we're supposed to be somewhere else, but we're supposed to be in the center of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have these two kids that I love more than I've ever loved anything in my whole life. They're 7 and 9. I'm divorced from their mother. We try to be good co-parents. I'm failing at that lately. She and I are not getting along like we have for the last 5 years, and it's difficult. It's getting more difficult by the day. But I love those kids. I've never met somebody who I would, like, die for. I know in the Navy I said I would, but I was hoping it wouldn't come to that. But with my kids, it's like, you know, Kent, I do love you. I do. But if you and I are out at Starbucks later, and some guy comes in wielding a gun and says, it's either you or the tall guy, I'm going to go, my friend Kent, right here. But if it's my kids, I jump in front of that, like that. I would never trade my kids for the first drink, never in a million years, but I'm alcoholic. I know what it means to be alcoholic. Although I would never trade them for the first drink, I would trade them for the second drink, just like that. So there's nothing that's more important than me sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, doing what you guys asked me to do. So again, Ralph, it's a privilege and an honor to be asked to come here and talk for a while and be a part of this amazing thing that you're sticking your neck out to do this weekend. And you guys are going to have a spectacular weekend. I'm going to be sitting here soaking up every word from some of my biggest heroes. Have a great night.
What a brilliant talk.